Case number 13-5011 et al. Alina Health Services, doing business as Abbott Northwestern Hospital, doing business as Cambridge Medical Center, doing business as Owatonna Hospital, doing business as United Hospital, doing business as Unity Hospital et al. Versus Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary, United States Department of Health and Human Services, Appellant. Ms. Marcus for the appellant, Ms. Webster for the appellees.
Good morning.
Who are you doing business as today?
As your honors probably know, I am representing appellant Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of HHS. And in this case, the plaintiffs challenged the Secretary's calculation of their fiscal year 2007 disproportionate share hospital, or DSH, provision. In this particular case, the issue at stake involves the patient days of Medicare beneficiaries who are enrolled in Medicare Part C. And under the Medicare statute, to be enrolled in Medicare Part C, a patient must be entitled to benefits under Part A. And an important backdrop to this case is that considering this court's decisions in Northeast and Catholic Health together, this court has already determined that the Secretary's interpretation, the substantive interpretation of entitled to benefits under Part A, is consistent with the Medicare statute. But here, the district court invalidated the Secretary's 2004 rulemaking as applied to these Part C patient days on procedural APA grounds.
But the remedy was broader, wasn't it? If you win on the remedy on this case, that is to say, leaving it open for the department to deal with this as an adjudication, isn't this then a tempest in a teapot?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is, if we, we're hoping you won't even get to remedy, because we certainly think
I'm asking the question in reverse.
Yes, right. If you do, we do think that under Catholic Health and Chainery that the agency should be able to reach the same result by adjudication. So regardless of whether, now of course the agency couldn't then rely on the rule if the rule, if this court
obviously
affirmed.
Obviously.
Yes, but there would be nothing stopping the agency from having an adjudication, and even when you have an adjudication, an agency has the power to, and again, even if you're, you know, taking here, one of the important things is there can't be a reliance interest, as this court in Northeast found that it was problematic.
Well, now you're getting to the hypothetical question that would come up only if you did do it in an adjudication, right?
The adjudication can be retroactive.
In other words, if that case should come about, the other side will argue reliance interest and you'll argue against that, but the point is that's not before us now.
No, Your Honor.
Well, can I ask about that? I'm not sure that's not before us. Depending on what you're asking us to do, you're asking us to, with respect to remedy, to excise the part of the district court's opinion that says you have to apply what might be regarded as the other interpretation to these individual companies, correct?
Correct.
We can't excise that without concluding that it wouldn't violate, I mean, without saying that even if you did it on adjudication, we can only do it if we think that adjudication would actually permit you to do that. If we thought that even with adjudication you couldn't do that because of reliance, we wouldn't be able to excise it. So you would like a decision here on at least on the question of reliance.
Your Honor, I think just applying Catholic Health, where the court held that it didn't need, there was a dispute between the parties about what the Secretary's policy was with respect to a different type of patient days there, the dual eligible exhausted coverage days. And in that case, this court held that it didn't need to determine what the Secretary's policy was, that by adjudication by its nature was retroactive, and that you could replace old law with new law in an adjudication, and unless it did violate the settled expectations of the parties.
There may not be a big difference between Judge Garland and myself. I think Catholic does suggest strongly a lack of reliance interest, but it's not. It wouldn't be squarely before. I don't think it's squarely before us now, in order to determine that the remedy is improperly stated. In other words, I think if we concluded the remedy is too broad, that the adjudication is still available to you, we don't necessarily have to answer the question whether a reliance interest would be jeopardized in the event there was an adjudication against the hospitals. There's strong suggestion in Catholic social services, but it's not the whole thing.
Well, it's more, we actually said in the reading now, but it is unnecessary to this. The parties have extensively argued whether the Edgewater interpretation constituted a legal about face. You don't have to decide that because Catholic Health has presented no explanation as to how it relied to its detriment on the alleged prior policy.
That's right.
So we have to at least.
But we don't have that. Well, because Catholic is not before us now. It would be another. Plane.
Right, but so. To be consistent with Catholic, we'd have to at least conclude that they haven't raised a reliance claim, which is
well. As we point out in our brief, they can't here because as of 2004, sort of regardless of any procedural issues, certainly they were on notice of the secretary's policy. There wasn't a settled expectation that these days would be treated any differently, and that's. We're not talking about what the pre-2004 policy was. Excuse me. We're talking about what the settled expectations were. If you vacate the remedy, this, again, is assuming that you affirm the district court's notice ruling, which we think is it certainly should be reversed and is completely erroneous. But if you did and you then vacated the portion of the remedy that prohibited the agency on remand from doing the same thing by adjudication, then the hospital would have to prevent the agency from doing the same thing, make a showing that that it was necessary to protect the settled expectations, and they can't do that in this case.
Let me go back to your basic point, which is the notice.
Yes.
Your general proposition, which I actually Judge Posner wrote a good opinion on this, your general proposition is if an agency gives a notice of proposed rulemaking suggesting two options, when the notice indicates the agency is inclined to option A, or clearly states two options, then parties are on notice that either option might be taken, even without regard to comments, which is your basic position here.
Yes, Your Honor.
The problem with that is your notice doesn't really say that, does it?
Yes, I think it does say that because here, if you look at the notice, the 2003 NPRM, and on pages A22 and A23 of our addendum, the agency presented the problem first by saying what the issue was. We've received questions about whether patients enrolled in a Part C plan should be counted in the Medicare fraction or the Medicaid fraction.
Is that an essential part of your argument? In other words, suppose, and I'm not acquiescing in the notion that that gets you over the bar, but if that part, the prefatory language, wasn't in there and all you had was the part that says, therefore, we are proposing to clarify that and what comes. I guess you'd have to do something with the therefore, obviously, but we're proposing to clarify that. But that wouldn't be enough to give notice. So you're relying on the stuff that you started to quote that comes
before. I think what I just quoted is very helpful to our argument. I don't think it's necessary because of the sentence that follows that, which is not the proposing sentence. It's the question stem from whether M+C plan, which is what Part C plans were called then, M+C plan enrollees are entitled to Medicare Part A because Part C plans are administered through Medicare Part C.
I'll tell you what troubles me in addition to that, though, is nonetheless we believe there should not be a major impact associated with this proposed change. Now, in Northeast, we concluded that there were hundreds of millions of dollars at stake if you took the opposite position. That is to say, if Medicare Part C people were included within the Part A, eligible for Part A fraction, hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. Now, that certainly would, at least arguably, lead people who were looking at this to think, uh-oh, this is not a serious matter, this is not a big deal. And in fact, if you put C people into the Medicaid side, it wouldn't be big, very significant, because C people tend to be more affluent. There are not going to be very many C people in the Medicaid fraction. But then if you put C people in the denominator of the other fraction, the Medicare fraction, you really do make a major economic change. Isn't that fair?
Your Honor, it isn't when looking at what the agency was doing in 2003. The agency admitted that it did not have data readily available to assess the impacts
Counsel,
of the
you're
change.
You're not answering my question. Well, I don't know. I'm not following.
I'm not sure how...
We go to the notice, and the notice says there should not be a major impact associated with this proposed change. Well, that's true if you're talking about putting C in with Medicaid. That shouldn't be a major change, because there are very few C people who will qualify for Medicaid. Because C generally, I remember reading both in Northeast and elsewhere, that people on Medicare Part C tend to be affluent, so they're not going to be Medicaid patients. So if you put them in the Medicaid fraction, you're not going to have a significant impact. Right?
Oh, Your Honor, and that I think that, you know, that certainly was that because to be in Part C, you have to be enrolled in Part B, the thought was that in Northeast, that is what I think the expectation was. But nonetheless, the agency has more recent data, much more recent data that shows that that supposition might not be true. And the agency in 2003 just didn't know and said it didn't know. And I think part of that is you don't...
Wait a minute. We believe there should not be a major impact associated with...
Well, part of the reason, we don't know how many Part C patients are in any hospital. It may be that some hospitals are hardly affected by this at all. I mean, that's not saying that for the hospitals who have a lot of Part C patients, there won't be a big... I mean, the agency's looking at... This is part of the...
Isn't this fairly well known that those who are on Medicare Part C tend to be affluent? These are called Medicare Part Advantage people. These are the people who are eliminated by Obamacare, right?
You don't have to answer that.
No, that's true. No, that is true. I mean, that's not an argumentative point. That is true, isn't it?
Your Honor, as I said, I think
Medicare Part Advantage is eliminated in Obamacare, isn't that correct?
I'm not sure.
Medicare Part C people tend to be affluent.
Well, I would refer you to Volume 78 of the Federal Register, 5615. This is the August 19th, 2013 final IPPS rule, where the agency actually has some new data that shows that supposition actually is not necessarily true, that people in...
So it's not... You now have information that is contrary to what you put in the notice.
The notice
notice, of course, was going to put them into Medicaid fraction, and it said there won't be a substantial impact. Now you're concluding that it might be a substantial impact if it was in Medicaid.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I think this chart shows that it's not it's the people in Part C are not necessarily more affluent. Is if you look at this chart in the agency's most recent rule. But I think what's important is going back to the notice itself, where what the agents, and I think the understanding of this is when you're looking at the financial impact, they're looking at just one part of the DSH provision for every hospital. There are so many things that go
all
in.
All right, let me go on, because, you know, money does...
Oh, of course, Your Honor.
Impact on whether people have adequate notice.
But, Your Honor, I think a
in your final rule, you say, based on analysis from our actual staff, we anticipate the impact of all four of these policy changes, which include three more beyond the one we're talking about, to be less than $50 million for fiscal year 2005. Northeast said it was hundreds of millions.
That statement was in the preliminary section of Northeast and wasn't, you know, a factual finding or holding in the case. And again,
this
looking...
This is not true? You mean what the court said was wrong? We should ignore it because we're just wrong?
Your Honor, I think what's important is that the agency, in good faith, tried to analyze the data it had available to it. And with respect to...
How much money is at stake?
I think we still don't know exactly how
you
much money is.
Now. Wait a minute. You came up for argument here. You had to ask your client, how much money is at stake?
No, Your Honor, there is a very significant amount of money at stake. Yes.
Of millions of dollars.
I think that is probably right. And when I will say that when we did the ratios for given the district court's order. Doing interim payments with respect to the new ratios they would get under the district court, that it affected a number of the hospitals, most of the hospitals favorably and a couple unfavorably. I am talking about what the agency knew in 2003 when it issued the notice, because the legal issue is whether the regulated community got enough information that if they were interested in the answer to this question, they should submit comments. And a hospital would be just as likely to know, about what if Part C enrollees are generally more affluent, then the hospital would know that too. And it's significant.
That's why they would think that putting them in the Medicaid fraction wouldn't be significant.
They know. That in the Medicare fraction, I think what they would be more concerned about in that situation is them being put in the denominator of the Medicare fraction, because that would tend to make that fraction lower.
Lower and causing a lot of money.
But
what about the fact that even after you come out with your final rule, you say, based on an analysis from our actuarial staff, we anticipate the impact of all four of these policy changes to be less than $50 million for fiscal 2005.
I think that the agency part
of... Does that mean you were just wrong? I mean, you just didn't know what you were doing then?
And again, you're taking all four proposals together.
Right.
And I do know now that the Part C and the dual-eligible exhausted coverage days do have a significant financial impact, and we're not disputing that. But I think you were including two other proposals also, and I don't know which way
those proposals add money. They don't reduce money. My point is $50 million is relative peanuts compared to hundreds of millions of dollars. And that suggests that even you weren't thinking that this was a big impact. And then so you switch positions and say, well, it's no harm.
I think part of the problem, Your Honor, is that we state in this notice that it appears likely that there is some variation in how these days are currently being handled. So we actually thought that some fiscal intermediaries were already putting them and some weren't, and there was some variation. It was clearly the Secretary's policy that they should not go in the Medicaid fraction, but...
They should not go in the Medicaid fraction. Therefore, we're proposing to clarify.
No!
Suggests you wanted to put them in the Medicaid.
We wanted to. Yes, we wanted. That suggests that we wanted to start putting them in the Medicaid trash, and we were acknowledging that there was some variation with what was happening already, and because we also are acknowledging that the agency had received questions, some of the comments expressed appreciation for us actually trying to resolve this issue because of the confusion. And I think given the confusion, it was very hard for the agency to determine what, if any, significant financial impact this would have, because it wasn't clear exactly where these were going. When Part C was enacted and the Balanced Budget Act, there wasn't a direction from Congress about what should happen with these stays, so it wasn't clear at that point. And the Secretary, as this Court stated in Northeast, the Secretary's regulations didn't address this until this rulemaking. So it became clear to the Secretary in doing this proposed rule that there was confusion. And I think because of this confusion, it really wasn't clear what kind of impact it would have. And I certainly think that a regulated party who saw this notice and was faced with what's most important here is what is congressional intent. And to determine congressional intent, you need to look at the statutory language. And that issue was squarely posed.
How do you separate? Look, we do have a opinion, the Environmental Integrity Project opinion, which using such, you know, famous law Latin as no surprise switcheroos and no flip-flops without notice, does stand for the proposition that at least in some circumstances where the agency says we're proposing to do X and then does the exact opposite Y, needs a new notice. Now, how do you separate, how is that distinguishable from this case?
Well, in Environmental Integrity Project, Your Honor, the EPA, in its proposed rulemaking, expressly stated that it was proposing to codify the understanding set forth in two previous adjudications, orders that were binding.
Why is that? Here they say we are proposing to clarify. Clarify meaning we are proposing to clarify that once a beneficiary elects Medicaid, Medicare Part C, those days are attributable. I appreciate the word clarify and codify are not the same just because they both begin with C, but they do sound not that much different. We're clarifying. You wouldn't say clarify if you were actually changing your position.
I think it reflects the fact that there was no policy prior to this rulemaking, that no matter what the agency did, it was going to clarify what should be done.
In the final rule, you refer to this as a policy change, right? In the 2004 rule, it says, we do not anticipate that these policy changes will have a significant impact on payment. Didn't you think this was a policy? Doesn't that suggest that you thought what you're doing is a policy change?
Yes, I think there was a vacuum where there was no policy, and that's why there were so many questions and it needed clarification. Whereas in the environmental integrity case, the EPA had actually issued two adjudications, and these were binding orders, and the agency in its notice of proposed rulemaking went through what it had already held in those orders. If HHS was doing the same thing in 2003, you would expect it would have cited some prior policy and adjudication or something, or it would have said, consistent with our prior policy, we're doing X. It didn't, because there was no prior policy. I think that this, you know, in this EPA case, if you look at the actual notice of proposed rulemaking, it's very different. In the detail, it talks about these orders and the language it uses. It didn't, because it was talking about codifying already binding rulings, and this court itself referred to these prior rulings as definitive rulings, it didn't indicate to regulated parties that the issue was open for consideration. Here, the NPRM, by using the word proposing, showed that it was just that. It was a proposal. And it presented the statutory interpretation question, which is the most important, the central question that the agency needed to answer here.
I guess, though, what it seems like is that what you were proposing to do isn't to revisit wholesale which direction you were going to go. It's that you were proposing to clarify. And so that was the proposal on the table. And so if you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who actually understands the ex-ante state of affairs, and I take your point that there was confusion about that, but who reads this to say the state of affairs now is that Part C beneficiaries are excluded, and what the agency is proposing to do is just to formally recognize that. It's almost ministerial. We're formally recognizing that. And then you ask yourself whether that potential commenter would have felt the need to weigh in to preclude the possibility that you might go in the other direction. Seems like that commenter might think, well, I don't need to say anything because what you're proposing to do is just codify, clarify the practical state of affairs now, and I'm completely comfortable with that.
Well, I think that the language before the sentence, or just the proposing to clarify sentence, shows that there's a real interpretive question that has two and only two answers.
That's definitely true. So I think that's hard to dispute. But then if the way the foundation is laid is to say there's an interpretive question as to which there's two and only two answers, we've looked at that question before, and we've reached the conclusion that the answer is X rather than Y. And now what we're proposing to do is formalize that it's X.
But if we had looked at that question before, presumably we would have said in the notice, oh, as we said in X decision, or as our regulation reflects, or it's a very strange way of doing it.
Isn't that what you said in Northeast to the court? We say, rather, the Secretary says the amendment merely confirmed her longstanding view that MNC gays should be included in the Medicare fraction.
We acknowledge this court's ruling in Northeast that our practice belied that argument, and the practice was not to put the Part C days in the Medicare fraction. However, what that was saying, what we did in the final rule, reflects our longstanding interpretation, and we still completely stick by the position that our statutory interpretation has never changed, that entitled to benefits under Part A means someone who meets the requirements for age.
I think that if you had said that in the 2003 proposal, we wouldn't be here, because then you would be putting people on notice that the thing that you ended up with is what is at a very good chance of ending up. Then they would have been incentivized, as they say, to weigh in. But in the notice, you don't actually say that. You sort of say, well, on the one hand, this is possible. On the other hand, this is possible.
But Your Honor, as this court stated, found in Northeast, there, because there was this question caused by, we aren't saying anything in here that's different about being entitled to benefits under Part A, but because the Medicare Part C plan enrollees, their benefits are administered under Part C, there may be some, at least an ambiguity with respect to Part C days that we thought was not there for the dual eligible days. But the agency was identifying what could be the cause of this confusion. And by the agency does say, we do not have data readily available to assess the impacts of this proposed change in the MPRM. So though it says clarifying, and we are proposing to clarify, it also describes it as a proposed change. So, I think that reflects the fact that we didn't have the contrary policy, and that, in fact, we've gone through, I know that the statutory interpretation question has already been answered in Catholic Health and Northeast and in this court's decision in Hall. But there was some of the confusion stemmed from a prior interpretation that the Secretary had of the four such days parenthetical.
Where's the part you just quoted about lacking data? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is on page 823 of our addendum. It's on page 68 Federal Register 27416. And
this is in the NPR?
It's in the MPRM.
And what does it say?
it says we do not have data readily available to assess the impacts of this proposed change.
And is it talking about this particular issue? Or is
yes.
It...
Well, then, how come you say nevertheless, we believe there should not be major impact associated with this proposed change?
I think that was just the agency's good faith estimate.
Well, you didn't read that. You didn't read that. You only read the first part.
Oh, right. But I was just responding to the point that in the NPRM itself, it is very different from the NPRM in environmental integrity, where they said they were codifying a binding definitive interpretation. Here, we said we are proposing, we're making a proposal, and though we did use the word clarify, we also...
We also say there should not be a major impact associated with this proposed change. I'm trying to sit down thinking as a lawyer representing hospitals. I'm trying to figure out if my client calls me and said, do we have to comment on this? Have to pay you legal fees to comment on this? And I'd say, not as long as you're happy with Part C being put in the Medicaid fraction.
But presumably the hospital then, you know, if it...
I mean, you'd have to be right. Almost clairvoyant to think, yep. Oh, you're going to flip your position and say C is going to be put in Part A.
Your Honor, I would look here. We actually have a number of comments from hospitals.
I think that's hysterical because those comments are so confused as to what the present situation is. There really is the blind was leading the blind here between the commenters and the agency.
Well, Your Honor, there are even a couple plaintiffs here who actually advocated what they're now opposing.
I know because there's total confusion.
Well, but in the confusion, Congress...
I mean, confusion as to your prior policy. Because part of it was implemented by, not by you, but by the carriers, the insurance...
By the fiscal intermediaries.
The fiscal intermediaries, and they were all over the lot.
But in that situation, when you have an agency that comes forward and gives you the binary choice...
If you had given the binary choice, you've got all of us in agreement with you.
But I think that the agency did right here when it says the question stems from whether Part C enrollees are entitled to Medicare Part A because the MPLC plans are administered through Medicare Part C. They have to be entitled to Part A to be in Part C, but at the same time, their benefits are administered by Part C.
I wonder whether the binary choice here really wasn't between clarifying and just leaving it as it was. So the proposal is we are proposing to clarify that once a beneficiary elects Medicare, et cetera. If they decided not to adopt the proposal, it would have just been left exactly where it was, which was in some confusion. Why wasn't that the binary choice people were thinking that they were facing?
When an agency comes forward and says we're doing this because there is confusion and there are questions and then presents an interpretive question that has just two choices and essentially says they're entitled to benefits under Part A, these days go in the Medicare.
Well, there's another possibility entirely. You could have handled it without a regulation, but through adjudication, which is what you want to do now anyway. So that was another choice. No regulation at all. Handle it through adjudication.
Right. Well, though, Your Honor, we would certainly prefer that we just...
But that was a possibility. Yeah.
That was a possibility at the
time, true that there were two regulatory choices.
But the notice
is... In other words, you understand what I mean?
Yes.
It's not true that there were only two regulations that could be issued. There was also the possibility of dealing it through adjudication, which is now what you want to do anyway.
Your Honor, we would only want to do that if we lose on the notice issue. We certainly
think... No, I'm trying to say what was available originally. It's not just confusion, it's adjudication.
But I think the point is that by identifying it as an area where there's confusion and there's a need for solving that confusion, that told parties we want to do this by regulation.
Actually, one case of an adjudication would have resolved the issue as well as a regulation.
Well, the rulemaking would,
I know, there are certain benefits to rulemaking. Yes. I'm not denying that. And, you wouldn't discourage.
And I do think that, you know, that in the notice cases that the circuit has had, they haven't said, well, the agency could have done this by adjudication, so therefore it wasn't clear. They could have just done nothing. There are cases such as, like, the Northeast Maryland waste case that we rely on where the agency had the kind of binary choice that is available here, and it did end up doing the opposite of what it originally proposed. And in that case, this court said the notice was adequate, even though it did the opposite, and even though parties complained about it. That's because there were two choices. This is like a statutory coverage case. If you say we're going to, and I believe one of the Long Island Care case cited by the plaintiffs in the Supreme Court case where you have whether the FLSA covers a certain kind of worker. The Supreme Court there said the notice was fine. I mean, it is one or the other. Either they're covered or they're
Suppose
not.
Suppose you had said in this notice of proposed rulemaking some more added words, which I don't think really add a lot, which were that including C days in the Medicaid fraction does not have a major economic impact. Because there are few C-eligible people who are also Medicaid-eligible. Suppose you had said that.
I don't think it would have changed the fact
that... It still would have been a binary choice.
Yes, and I think what the important... And I think the commenters recognize this by commenting on the statutory interpretation question posed. In fact, when the agency in its final rule decided to actually change its mind, it was agreeing with the comment of the Association of American Medical Colleges, which represents hundreds of medical colleges, so it's not just one commenter, it's an association that represents many. And it says these people, when they choose Part C, are just as much Medicare beneficiaries as, you know, people who are not in Part C, because they have to be entitled to benefits under Part A. So that...
Well, Lord knows, we're not prepared to argue with your statutory interpretation question in light of our cases.
And I think when you look at what Congress did here, it made two proxies. And they're just proxies. They're not exact measures. And one, the Secretary is charged with implementing Congress's intent. And in one fraction is a proxy for the percentage of low-income Medicare patients.
We have it, Counsel.
Okay.
I have two statutory questions for you. On this possibility of a retroactive effect from adjudication, what do you think the import of 1395HH2 is, which says no rule requirement or other statement of policy that establishes or changes a substantive legal standard governing the scope of benefits shall take effect unless it is promulgated by the Secretary by regulation?
Your Honor, that, as we cited in our brief, and we have a number of authorities that say that that part of the Medicare statute has been interpreted to be essentially reflecting of APA standards, and so if there's not an APA problem, there's not a separate Medicare statute problem. There also isn't isn't a retroactivity problem under either, because again, all of the regulated parties were on notice since 2004.
Assume there is a problem about that. I'm asking, what does this section preclude the making of this requirement by adjudication? That's my question.
No, Your Honor.
I know that's the answer you would give. I want to know the reason.
Because that section doesn't go beyond anything in the APA, and as this court stated in Catholic,
where does it say that it doesn't go beyond? When you say it doesn't go beyond anything stated in the APA, what do you mean by that?
Let's see. That courts have generally construed the procedural requirements in 1395HH to be coextensive with those under the APA.
Well, that's a pretty broad statement. That's not really going to get us to where we need to be on this specific thing.
I think that it doesn't, that in that it was Congress there was trying to give the Secretary rulemaking authority to do things retroactively that it might not otherwise. It's not taking away the authority to do normal adjudications. It's trying to give the, I think that the Secretary, if it's going to make something retroactive, I think it would have to do it via rulemaking, but the
this the is not only about retroactive. This is no requirement that establishes or changes shall take effect unless it's promulgated by the Secretary.
The
opposing counsel cited this, so I'll be asking them the same question. Let me ask them about another one. Now I'm on E. No, I'm on I. E.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on. Now I'm on E. Retroactivity of substantive changes. So I'm basically asking whether the following statement that we made in Northeast Hospital is wrong. So we said in Northeast Hospital, we are aware of no statute that authorizes the Secretary to promulgate retroactive rules for DSH calculations. And as I happen to be looking through this very complicated statute in connection with this case, it says, titled, Retroactivity of Substantive Changes. And it says, a substantive change in regulations shall not be applied retroactively unless the Secretary determines that such retroactive application is necessary to comply with statutory requirements. So wasn't your argument in Northeast Hospital that it was necessary to comply with statutory requirements?
Yes, because we had a plain language.
So did we make a mistake because nobody called this statute to our attention, or
Catholic Health, we were making a Chevron 1 argument. Northeast, we were making primarily a Chevron 2 argument.
Do you think that this statute, had we known about it, would have led to a different result in Northeast? That it could have been applied retroactively because the Secretary thought it was necessary comply with statutory requirements, or is there something I'm missing here? Maybe necessary means Chevron step one rather than Chevron step two or something like that.
Your Honor, I think that does give the Secretary the authority when there is it would have to be something, I guess, in the statute, which we thought was, that what we were doing, our essential interpretation, was longstanding and best implemented the interpretation of entitlement to benefits under Part A. And in that respect, I think because we didn't have any policy or anything in the regulation prior to that, there wasn't anything in the 2004 rulemaking that said we're going to make this retroactive and this is why we're doing it. There wasn't any, because we didn't think it was retroactive.
I see.
Counsel, I'm a little confused. I don't remember which party brought this to our attention, the statute that Judge Growlin is referring to.
No party. I'm just asking because you're the expert on this subject. I'm asking for your advisory opinion.
Well,
but your lack of one is fine because, as Judge Silverman points out, nobody raised this point.
Well, no, I think
it's not relevant to this case. As long as we're here.
As long as you're here, you want to see if Northeast was wrongly decided. Yeah. We'll take that too.
I didn't like Northeast.
Yeah, but I was on a panel. I always worry about making mistakes. Okay. Any further questions? None? Next slide.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephanie Webster. I represent 30 nonprofit hospitals. that contended that this court should affirm the district court's decision vacating the agency's 2004 rule for failure to provide proper notice or any explanation for its interpretation change in 2004. I'd like to start by talking about...
Is your basic argument notice, or is your basic argument basis and purpose?
I'd like to talk about notice first. I think that
which
that
is your... I thought your basic argument was notice.
Yes.
Yes. Not the basis and purpose argument.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And as your questions demonstrated, Judge Silverman, I think that there is a significant notice problem.
Can I go to question that I started counsel with the other side?
Sure.
It's more of a problem for you. If we were to vacate reverse the district judge in order of vacating of the rule, but change the remedy to not preclude the government from handling this matter through adjudication. Isn't it a Pyrrhic victory for you?
That would be a Pyrrhic victory, but we believe that the agency cannot proceed through adjudication in this
Is that
situation.
Legitimately before us at this point?
The question as to whether they can proceed through adjudication?
Yes.
Sure, because the reason that they can't proceed through adjudication is because there is a prior definitive interpretation that can't be changed at this point.
Definitive interpretation of what?
Of the DISH provision.
Of the statute?
Well, I think it's of the statute and the regulation.
What regulation?
The regulation 412.106.
Well, when was that issued?
The 412.106 was initially issued back in 1986.
Uh-huh.
As this court found in the Catholic Health decision, there is a provision in the May 1986 Federal Register that speaks of the Part A Medicare Part A SSI fraction, including only covered Part A Medicare days. And in our view, that rule addresses the question as to whether Part C days should be included in the Part A SSI fraction.
Well, is that argument before the district judge?
The argument regarding the regulation?
Now, the one you're making now, that an adjudication unfavorable to you could not be issued because it would be inconsistent with the regulation that was in effect in 1986?
Right. We argued that the prior rule would prevent the...
But why would that even be relevant? Because what you were challenging was a regulation, not an adjudication. I don't think that issue was before the district judge.
Well, it only came up to the extent that the government argued that the court could not order the recalculation of the SSI fractions because the government had the authority to go back and achieve the same result through adjudication.
What was that again? What did you say that?
The government argued at the district court that our request that the district court order a recalculation of the 2007 fractions not be granted because they could achieve the same.
Yes, okay, I understand that. And your response to that was what? Your response to that was no, the agency could not proceed through adjudication because of a prior regulation that would be inconsistent with the adjudication. Is that your point?
Yes.
But that really is not before the district judge, was it?
The district court did not make a finding on that, no.
All right, so the point is, the remedy that the district judge issued exceeded the issue before her. The issue before her was the notice of the alleged inadequacy of the notice of proposed rulemaking. If she was correct in concluding that you were right, that the notice was inadequate, and we should agree with that, then we do not reach the question of whether the government can proceed through an adjudication or not, do we? We don't properly.
That's correct, because the proper remedy would be vacator of the rule, and that would not allow adjudication.
That would not allow adjudication? No, it would be up. It would be that wouldn't be before us, right? That issue is not before us. That's what you said. That was correct. It's not before us. Whether the agency can proceed through adjudication And whether you have arguments against that is not before us in this case.
I agree with that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so...
So I have a question. How do we distinguish this argument about notice from what happened in the Northeast Maryland waste disposal case, where we said, by announcing that it proposed to distinguish between refractory and non-refractory units, EPA invited comments on both the pros and cons of that distinction. It thus effectively served notice that if persuaded the latter outweighed the former, the distinction might not survive.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, that was not the agency. The agency was taking its first step in interpreting the standard, in setting forth the standard, which is not the situation here. Here, the agency was clarifying what its prior longstanding policy had been with respect to the Part A SSI fraction.
Why does that matter? In that case, the agency said we're proposing three subcategories. How did anybody know that in the end they were only going to do two? How did anybody know that they were going to not distinguish between these two subcategories when they said that they were proposing to do that? Why is that different than this case, where they're proposing to do one thing and noting what the other thing would be, and then did the other thing?
Sure. It's different because in that situation, that was the agency's first foray into the area. And so there wasn't any reason for, say, a hospital CFO to conclude, oh, this is just a clarification of existing policy. And here, reading the words in the Federal Register in 2003, the hospital CFO is going to think, okay, well, there's nothing to see here. No major impact, clarifying what's been happening since 1997.
You don't think somebody could think that they might be persuaded by comments to go the other way? I mean, they asked for comments.
They asked for comments.
Do you have to ask for comments when you give notice that you're proposing to do something? That's implied by the notice, right? There's an opportunity to comment.
Under CSX, an agency has to request comments on a specific proposal, and the agency just didn't do that. And it's actually interesting.
Where does it say they have to? If you have a long set of proposals, you say we propose to do this.
Right.
Where in the APA does it say that you have to specifically ask for comments on that proposal? All you have to do, the APA says notice and an opportunity for comment. It doesn't say notice and a request for comment.
Fair enough. I think that one thing that is actually helpful is to look at what the agency typically says when it's issuing these rules, because if you put this in context, you see that actually when the agency is considering a change in policy, it says that, and it actually also specifically requests comments on that proposal, and they simply didn't do that here. There are examples in the very same NPRM where you find this initial clarification that demonstrate that.
Well, it does say at the beginning, comments will be considered if received at the appropriate address as provided below no later than 5 p.m. on July 18, 2003. It doesn't say only comments on some things. It just says comments.
That's true, but I think under CSX, the agency is required to do more than that.
Under CSX?
CSX, right.
Tell me where it says in that case that the agency has to ask for comments on a specific proposal.
It's at 584F3-1082. They have to request comments on a particular issue.
I'll read it while the other judges ask questions if they have any more.
I hope you'll forgive me, I do not have any further questions.
All right, I'll look at it later. Do you have any further questions? All right. Does the government have any time? All right, I'll give you another couple minutes to answer what's been raised.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to address your question again about 42 U.S.C. 1395 HHA4. And notably, that states that the agency can't change a substantive legal standard. And as we discussed, here there was no binding notice and comment regulation. There wasn't a substantive legal standard in place, regardless of what our practice was. And therefore, you know, that certainly wouldn't have any bar in adjudication in this case. And Your Honor, as you stated, we identified in our reply brief where the IPPS rule as a whole does certainly expressly ask for comments. It sets a deadline. And when you have a really big rulemaking like this with lots of different proposals and numbers 8, 9, the agency doesn't necessarily ask with respect to each proposal. It is understood, and the comments as a whole to this rule are voluminous. And the agency also...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. Back on this question about I think it was HH2 that you were just talking about, substantive legal standard. I thought it was HH2 rather than HH4. Am I getting the provision wrong?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, A2. Excuse me.
HH2. So it says... No rule requiring another statement of policy that establishes or changes. So it doesn't matter if it's a change. It can't establish it either.
But, if we're going to establish it in a rulemaking, certainly in adjudication, you are able to act by adjudication, as this court clearly held in Catholic Health. And that was even if we had a different policy. So unless we had some binding regulation that said we are doing it this different way, it is clear in this circuit that that HHS can act by adjudication.
I think the problem is it's not clear in the Second Circuit what this means, but it's not clear in our circuit because we've never addressed this before. The Second Circuit, opinion by Judge Jacobs, Yale New Haven Hospital, says that the purpose of this section was to distinguish between policy statements of agencies and regulations of agencies that had nothing to do with adjudications. It's just a restatement of the APA rule that if you're going to make a substantive change, you need to do it by regulation, even if you call it a policy.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. And I think that does reflect, as we noted in our brief, that this circuit and two other circuits have also held that these provisions
sure
in HH are...
I'm just very, very grateful that Judge Garland hasn't criticized Catholic
I was on that one, too.
And though this isn't relevant to this case, Judge Silverman, I have been told that Obamacare does not eliminate Medicare Advantage.
Why did I read that?
I don't know.
But it is true that Medicare Advantage is generally chosen by more affluent people.
We don't think that the most recent data we have is reflected in the 2013 final rule. That does not appear to be true. But that was
not as totally true. It is still proportionally true.
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't.
I thought I saw that in some of the data.
And I also can't speak to what kind of effect it has to individual hospitals. It's going to vary.
I'm sure you're right about that.
Yes, and that is something that depends not just on Part C, and it depends on SSI entitlement, what state you're in, what their SSI Medicaid policies are.
It's true, because SSI is independent of income. The disability payments are independent of income.
Right, though SSI certainly isn't.
But that portion of SSI.
Unless there are further questions, we ask that you reverse the district court.
Seeing none, we'll take the matter under submission.
Thank you.